We are really pleased today to have Dr. Austin Potts, professor of Bible at Philadelphia College of Bible, to come and to speak to us on the Sinai. Dr. Potts is a graduate of PCB as well as Wheaton Graduate School, and he earned the PhD from Dropsy University. Dr. Potts, we welcome you today, and we're very glad to have you come and speak to us.
I'm glad for this opportunity to be with you here at Biblical Seminary. We've had some very fine contacts in the last few weeks, especially between Biblical Seminary and Philadelphia College of Bible. Our paths have crossed recently with Dr. Dunbar, who came to visit us about 2 weeks ago at the college, and then at the meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society, had an opportunity to meet with Dr. Newman. And as I read from the periodicals, I find many articles written by members of your faculty. I don't dare begin to name some of them, lest I omit some that I should mention. But I found some articles recently in the Grace Journal and a number of other periodicals written by your own faculty. I'm proud to say that I have two sons-in-law who have attended here or who are now attending here. Lou Maialano, who graduated 3 years ago, and my son-in-law, Todd Mangum, who is studying here now. And it's good to see, too, that there are quite a few PCB grads who, over the years, have attended here, and some are presently enrolled here at the seminary. So we're glad for these contacts that we have had. And, of course, you have a number of PCB grads on the faculty. Reminded of that as I look at Mr. Putnam sitting up here in the front. Today I want to talk about Sinai. In the summer of 1974, I had the opportunity of taking a camping trip down into Sinai with the hope of learning more about the sufferings and hardships that God's people faced when they were involved in the Exodus. And since that time, I've tried to read everything that comes across my path that deals with Sinai. I especially was concerned about visiting Sinai and then also keeping up with the study of Sinai. In light of the fact that some years ago, seven, 8 years ago now, the Sinai was turned over to the land of Egypt once more. So I was glad I was able to get into the Sinai area and to visit it and come back with some slides and some information that I've gained from that experience. As I begin today, I'd like to read just a few verses from Numbers chapter 11, which tells us a little bit about the hardships which God's people faced when they traveled in the Sinai region. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord, and when he heard them, his anger was aroused. Then fire from the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. When the people cried out to Moses, he prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down, so that the place was called Taberah, because fire from the Lord had burned among them. The rabble with them began to crave other food, and again the Israelites started wailing and said, "If only we had meat to eat. Remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost, also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna." And so these few verses remind us of the hardships which God's people faced as they traveled through Sinai. I want to show, with the aid of the overhead, the area of Sinai. Sinai is part of the desert country that extends all the way across North Africa. You can see Sinai in Western Asia. The desert country continues as a chain of desert country into Mongolia and into much Korea. It's something that I learned about some time ago, that kind of continuous chain of desert country, running from North Africa all the way to Asia, and it comes into Asia, and then goes northeast, and then
north of the Sinai Desert, and southern part of Europe, being Pyrenees Mountains in Spain. We have a chain, a huge chain of mountains. The Pyrenees, the Alps, having on down to the Turkey, going across the Holy Land, we have the Lebanon Mountains. And this chain of mountains goes through the central area and goes southeastward into the Himalayas. Again, why is it so? I don't know. But nevertheless, I find it an interesting observation. You know, this chain of desert country and chain of mountains. You might say that the Holy Land is the style of the two, in that in Sinai you have desert country, the southern Sinai is very mountains. And the desert country in Sinai, the northern parts of the Holy Land you have mountain country. Again, we need to share parts of those two very important regions. The desert country that we talk about in the course of Africa and the Middle East, and then also the Canyon Mountain country, extending from Spain all the way into the southern part of Southeast Asia. Now, just to the slide on Happy Day, I'm going to go to the slide very quickly left, and I'm going to the slide. I want to go to the slides out of the country and the show slide, the main thing that I want to share with you. I can't attend again early one morning, and you can do this down to the territory and down along the western shore of the Dead Sea, down to the Arafa, and down to the Kurbala. My lot is along the Gulf of Aqaba, sometimes seeing the Gulf of Aqaba, sometimes going 800 miles, and outside of the Gulf. You can go down the very tip of Sinai, called Gulf Muhammad, and then west, westward towards the door. You can see some of the oil fields that the Mount Bay, the Mount Monticus, have been utilized. Some of the oil from Abu Dhabi. And then we went into the very modest time and started traveling into the desert country and the mountain country here in the vicinity of Mount Sinai. The southern trip is very rugged, very mountainous. The northern part has many open and bare plains. So we'll go from this now very quickly to the east side and the side between them.
I'd like to flip it back, take it back one. Maybe I can take it back from here. Excuse me. Yes. An aerial shot taken by some of our space travelers. I sometimes say this is a shot I took of my first space flight. Over the Sinai. You see the peninsula is triangular in shape. And the Sinai is actually part of the African geological fault. The eastern branch of this extends through the Dead Sea and the Jordan Valley. And of course, I'm sure you've heard the importance of that geographically. The southern tip of Sinai, you can see from the slide, is very mountainous. And then the northern two-thirds, not so difficult to travel in. Of course, the southern tip of Sinai is the traditional site of Mount Sinai. This was our vehicle for traveling, a four-wheel drive truck. We carried our luggage and sleeping bags on the top of the truck. We carried food, canned food, and also as much fresh food as we could in the trip. There were about 36 or 37 of us who traveled together. There were families with children. There were Southern Baptist missionaries who wanted to learn more about Sinai, who traveled with the group. There were Israeli army officers and also young recruits who joined in this. And we had a very good time together as we worked and studied together in this Sinai trip. This picture shows the international nature of our camping group. The young lady on the right was a student from University of Colorado. She was a Jewish student studying at Hebrew University, and she was in her junior year of studies. The young man in the white hat was from Germany, and he was a principal of a Christian day school in Israel. Again, it's difficult to do missionary work in Israel. If you do missionary work among the Arabs, among the Arab children, no problem. If you win a convert from among the Jews, you will face some opposition rather quickly. The young man at the top left of the picture is a Southern Baptist missionary. He worked at a camp site, a youth camp, in Israel. And the boy in the foreground was the son of a civil engineer from America. But he was working in Israel for a few years, making studies of the needs that Jerusalem would have for water and such things over the next 5, 10, 15 years. We're at the port of Eilat on the eastern branch of the Red Sea or the Gulf of Aqaba. It's not a very scenic spot, really, and so my picture is not that scenic either. But in the picture, taken back in 1974, we see a Persian oil tanker that is unloading oil at that port. And the oil will be pumped through a pipeline which goes across the northern extent of Sinai to the port of Ashdod on the Mediterranean coast of the Holy Land. This, of course, reminds us that at that time, in 74, that was just after the October War, which just preceded that, and also at that time, the Shah was still living and still ruling in Persia, and so the Persians did not adhere to the oil embargo, and so oil was being brought to Israel and, of course, to the Mediterranean world by this means. Just a little bit south of the port of Eilat is the what's called Coral Island. The ruins that you see on the island go back to the days of the Crusaders. Some say this might be the site of Ezi and Geber, where Solomon had his fleet of sailing ships. We know that he had a fleet, a small fleet on the Mediterranean, but probably a more important fleet on the Red Sea. Later, we read in the scriptures about the Queen of Sheba coming to visit Solomon. She came, and of course, she saw his splendor and his wealth and his gorgeous despotism. But she also may have come because Solomon's fleet may have been hindering her caravan trade. And so probably negotiations were made regarding that. Again, the scriptures do not mention that, but that seems like a great possibility. Just a few scenic shots showing the coastline of the of Sinai. And of course, you see the green coral reflected or seen in the shores, the waters along the shore. Farther south of Eilat, you have a place called Sharm el-Sheikh, a place that was a military installation, but also a place that was visited by modern Israelis in the wintertime especially, because the climate is very warm there generally, and oftentimes in the late fall and in the early spring, bathing and water sports can be enjoyed at this spot. Move down all the way to the very tip of Sinai, a place called Ras Muhammad, where you see a few Egyptian tanks were knocked out and left standing as relics of warfare. When you travel throughout the Holy Land and travel in Sinai too, you see oftentimes trucks of the enemy or tanks of the enemy have been knocked out in various places, and they remain in the place where they stopped and are war memorials, reminding the Israelis, the present Israelis, of some of the conflicts that they've had with their Arab neighbors since 1948. On the west side of Sinai, about one-third of the way up along the coast, there is a ghost town called Dor, D-O-R. And a number of boats here, and there is a quarantine center used by the Arabs during their Hajj, during the travels from northern parts of Egypt across southern Sinai and on towards Western Arabia. In the Arab people making the Hajj feel it's important to make the pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in a lifetime, and many of them travel through Sinai. As they returned home from the pilgrimage, they were checked by medical doctors at this site so they did not take any serious diseases back home with them. This is a general view of the southern part of Sinai. Along the coast, there may be roads. In some places, roads were paved. In some places, we made our own roads through the desert. And as you look from the coastal area into the interior, you see rugged mountains like this in many parts of the southern tip of Sinai. This is one of the most beautiful scenic shots that I have of the interior of the southern tip of Sinai. Off in the distance, there's a small oasis, and there were a few buildings in the distance. At this time, I had a very bad cold, had not joined the trek all the way into the oasis, but some of us rested here while others made that trek. A very beautiful scenic shot of the of the interior of Sinai. At this point, we are visiting a place called the Wilderness of Paran. And of course, we read about the Wilderness of Paran quite often in the as we study the Exodus and the Book of Numbers and the wanderings of God's people. And we're entering the Wilderness of Paran. In fact, this was one of the most well-watered and one of the most fertile spots that we found in Sinai. In many places where there were Bedouin encampments, we could see the Bedouin had flocks of sheep and goats. We saw small gardens, but the gardens were dried up. Very little that was raised in most places in Sinai by the Bedouin. In the foreground, you see a number of stone buildings, and you see also the acacia trees, which grow profusely in this area. The acacia tree, of course, is the tree from which wood was taken for the making of the tabernacle and the furniture of the tabernacle. And the acacia tree, of course, is native to Africa. And we're reminded here that Sinai is very important for the botanist in that there are about 1,000 different kinds of plants that are native to Sinai. And it's interesting for the botanist to note the interchange between, say, the plant life that you find in Sinai and the plant life that you find in Africa and also other plant life that you find in other parts of Western Asia. And so the study of the plant life, and with this also the study of animal life, is very crucial at Sinai because you have this important land bridge. The Sinai, of course, is a land bridge, not only for the study of, say, plant life and animal life, but also a very important land bridge between Africa and Western Asia, and to some extent, a land bridge between Africa and Europe. Along the coast of Sinai, along the coast of the Holy Land, you have the famous international highway called the Via Maris, the Latin name for the Way of the Sea, a very important trade route in Bible times. And of course, even today, even though as you travel through Sinai, you wonder why modern nations are fighting over the control of that area. And of course, realizing that the land bridge, that helps us understand why it is so strategic, even to this very day. Moving into the interior of the wadi here at the Wilderness of Paran, we come to a place where there's water in the foreground and some palm trees and other fruit trees, and behind it a mountain. At the very top of the mountain remains of a Byzantine church. And again, reminded of some church history. And the fact that between 300 and 600, the Byzantine church was very strong in the eastern part of the Roman Empire, and of course, strong in the Holy Land itself. We find at that time in history, in church history, some churches were built in very remote places. So that archaeologists have found remains of Byzantine church on the top of Masada, which is very barren. Here on the top of this mountain, in the interior of Sinai, remains of an ancient church. And of course, at this time in history, when religious men would go out into the wilderness and live like hermits, they were the beginning of the monastic type movement within some of the Eastern churches, and a very fascinating part of church history. I wish I had time to talk about this more fully. Another view of the remains of the church at the top of this mount. Eventually, we climbed up to the top. And from this vantage point, you see the rugged countryside all around. And yet this remote place you have remains of a church in the interior of Sinai. Going down again into the Wadi of Wilderness of Paran, again remains of a church located here. Move from Paran into the interior of Sinai and to the mountainous area of the southern tip. In this picture, we're looking at an acacia tree. I can't focus it from here. The acacia tree is, of course, a desert tree. It has very small leaves. And the small leaves, of course, would limit the loss of moisture to the dry desert air. And yet, and the desert, so the acacia tree can grow very well in the desert country. It will not grow at much in some, it will not grow at heights above 2,000 feet above sea level because of the danger of frost. The acacia tree has small leaves and has very sharp thorns on its branches. It has very deep tap roots that might go down 80, 90 feet beneath the surface. So the acacia tree can survive 7/8 years without any rainfall at all. Very well suited to the desert country. In the desert tree, you see a Bedouin tent that has been wrapped up and hung up in the tree. The Bedouin have the custom in this part of the country that a tree, or I should say, anything that's hung in a tree is private property. And so you take a tent that might be worth $1,000 in our money, fold it up and hang up in a tree, and the Bedouin seem to respect that law of the desert. People who lived here wander away for 2, 3, 4 months in search of green pasture for their flocks, and then after rain come to this area, the Bedouin who lived at this site would come back and set up their tent again and live in this area. The picture of the thorns that are found on the acacia tree. Oftentimes you see the camels feeding on the acacia tree. You notice that the limbs do not come down close to the ground level because the camels forage upon these trees a lot. And since they have to forage among those long thorns, I like to say, no wonder the camel is such a grumpy animal. We also see tamarisk trees growing in the desert country of Sinai. The tamarisk tree, very much like the cedar, green year-round, and this kind of tree found commonly in the desert country, along with the acacia tree. Again, as we talk about trees and plants, it should be pointed out that in the wadis, where occasionally there might be rainfall and occasionally a rush of water after the rainfall, we find that the plant life is carefully spaced, almost as though somebody had planted it that way. But you see a plant or bush, and then 20, 30 feet away from it, another plant or bush. But a plant or bush that tries to sprout between those two existing bushes probably will sprout but will die out because it lacks the moisture and the nourishment that needs to survive. And so you see a definite relationship of the plants in some of the desert countries. You also see in Sinai especially, there are plants that will drop off some of the extremities at the time when it's very dry. When the rains come, then the plant branches and leaves will grow and extend. When the droughts come, then those extremities will drop off at joints that are in the limbs or branches of the plant. And this way, some of the plants are able to survive. Along the coast of Sinai, we saw a number of oases that were formed by wadis that have their origin in the interior of Sinai. Occasionally, rains come to Sinai, and oftentimes the rainwater is not absorbed because the ground is baked hard and dry, and so there's a lot of runoff. Bedouin tents that are set up in the wadis sometimes are washed away. Sometimes there's loss of life. It's difficult to imagine that when you visit Sinai in the dry season. But occasionally torrents are that swift and that strong that people are drowned, or that the tents are washed away, or cars are washed away. Where the waters of the wadis come towards the Red Sea, oftentimes the waters will fan out and form an oasis like the one you see in the picture. It's interesting to look at the plant life and flowers and various kinds of plants that you see in the desert country. This kind of plant is a kind of plant used by the modern Israelis in the pickling of pickles. You see a plant with cotton-like tufts on the end of its little branches. Here, a begonia-like plant growing in the rock and dry ground. Another plant, don't have the names for these. Here, a mangrove bush growing in the salty waters along the shores of the Red Sea. In fact, along the shores of the Red Sea, you can see some very interesting tropical-like fish. And also, you see here the mangrove bush is growing in the salt water. Scientists have studied this bush with the thought of learning something about how to make fresh water out of salt water. Again, it can be done, but presently it's a very costly process. But the mangrove bush can grow in the salt water and exudes salt crystals on the underside of its leaves. And so for this reason, scientists have studied about the mangrove bushes. This dog seemed to be friendly, yet is afraid to approach much closer to her. But I'm reminded as we look at this dog that in Sinai and in Egypt and in Western Asia, dogs like the greyhound and the saluki and also the Afghan hound originally had their beginning. And again, when we see the greyhound, we're reminded of the dogs like this that still are found in Sinai. When we study the Bible, we find that dogs were primarily foraged for their food. If you gave a dog like this a can of Alpo, I'm sure he'd have to throw up. It'd be too rich for him or for her. Again, some of these dogs are now being imported from Israel. Some of them take on the name the Canaanite dog and are sold in some of the kennels in America. But again, as you look at this dog, I'm reminded of how much she looks like a greyhound. And of course, you look at ancient pictures from ancient Egypt, and you find that some of the dogs that are pictured in the paintings from ancient Egypt look very much like this dog. In this picture, a young man is pulling a lizard. Again, lizards are seen quite frequently in Sinai. Again, as you travel in desert country, in the midst of the day, you do not see much evidence of life. Those of you who have traveled in the American Southwest know what I'm talking about. But at night, the desert comes alive. And there are all kinds of creatures moving about. You have the gerbils and the lizards in the early morning and late in the evening that are active. You have the snakes moving about and so on. All kinds of creatures moving about in the desert country in the early morning and late evening and during the night. The lizards and snakes, of course, being cold-blooded creatures, live in burrows, oftentimes some 6 feet beneath the surface. And of course, there, 6 feet beneath the surface, it's quite comfortable. A cold-blooded creature like a lizard or a snake that does not get to its burrow before the sun comes up and before the sun gets hot will perish and become very lethargic and eventually will die. And so such creatures need to find shade and better still find a burrow if they are to survive the heat of the day. Looking here at a locust. And with our group, there was an Israeli army officer who was wearing a straw hat. He also something of an amateur scientist. And he was telling us about the locust. Again, we could spend quite a bit of time talking about the locust. We read about locust plagues, of course, in the Bible. Some years ago, National Geographic had a very fine article on the locust. It really was an article that was a condensation of a book by a man who gave his life to the study of the locust. Now, I'm afraid I couldn't limit my life to that much, to study about one little creature. But nevertheless, we benefit by the scholarship of men who can devote their life and devote their study to maybe just one little creature like the locust. But in the article it was mentioned that locusts at first may appear to be like grasshoppers and may appear to be as harmless as grasshoppers. But at a certain stage of their growth, it seems like, in part, it's influenced by the contact and touch of each other. Their color changes and their temperament changes from that of a grasshopper to the hungry insect that will wander across the countryside in great numbers and bring great destruction. If locust plagues are are nipped in the bud, if locusts are sprayed with insecticides or dusted with insecticides, early in their growth and development, locust plagues can be avoided. Again, in some of the countries of the world where locusts hatch, some of the countries do not get along too well with each other, and so it's difficult to control the locust plague. But locusts, as you know, can sometimes hop across the countryside, devouring everything in their path. Sometimes they carry by the winds and fly 10,000 feet above the earth. You see a hedgehog, a desert animal. The hedgehog seems like a cross between the groundhog and the porcupine. Very bashful kind of creature, nocturnal animal, and feeds upon vegetation. Here you see the black goat. Again, a lot we should say about the black goat, because the black goat is found throughout the Holy Land and throughout Western Asia and found throughout Sinai. It can survive in the harsh climate that you have in Sinai. And sometimes it seems like all the Bedouin have is a small flock of 20 or 30 black goats. Now, they utilize the black goat for food and they use the hair of the black goat for weaving of their tents. Some years ago, when I learned that the black tents of the Bedouin were made of black goat's hair, I wondered how this could give protection against the rain and the weather. Since then, I've learned that woven goat's hair, when it gets wet, swells. The fibers swell and makes an airtight and watertight protection from the elements. This is something the Bedouin knew all along. And we Westerners, who take pride in our knowledge, only gradually learn of these things. Again, the study of the Bedouin themselves is a very fascinating study, in that we see how the people can endure the harsh elements of the desert country, seemingly survive with very, very little. Very few of the comforts that we know of, and yet are happy and survive, even though they face these harsh elements all around them. In a few places in Sinai, we saw ruins of ancient settlements. Here we see the ruins of a tell near a crossroads in the midst of Sinai. Our group is scattered over the tell, searching for flint knives and flint tools. Also, in the southern tip of Sinai, we saw some Nabataean inscriptions. Nabataean inscriptions were written sometime between 200 BC and about 100 AD, most of them written in that period of time. The Nabataean inscriptions are written in various kinds of script. The inscriptions were not studied very carefully until about 10, 15 years ago, when the Sinai was about to be returned to the Egyptians. Then Israeli scholars went into Sinai in great numbers and photographed the inscriptions and studied the inscriptions with the thought of learning more about them. At first, the inscriptions were not studied very carefully because they didn't say very much. In most cases, the inscriptions were writings of those who were in charge of the caravans. They came to the shade of a cliff and rested their animals, and they themselves rested. And some of them would scrawl these inscriptions or make these drawings on the stone. The inscriptions don't say much more than Kilroy was here. But anyway, in recent years, in the last 10, 15 years, many of the inscriptions have been photographed and copied, and Israeli scholars especially have been translating them. Some of them written in early Arabic scripts, some of them written in what looks like a Armenian type script. I guess I would guess this looks to me a lot like ancient Armenian script. Also see the menorah, the seven-branch candlestick cut in the stone. Further into Sinai, we visited at some Bedouin encampments. Our guide had gained the friendship of some of the Bedouin who lived in the area. And at the time that we visited there, we found that, this is back in 1974, there were quite a few tourists who were beginning to visit in Sinai. And I'm glad I had this opportunity to live in Sinai to learn more about the experiences of God's people and to kind of sympathize or understand some of the difficulties that they encountered. In the foreground, you see a well, and in front of the well, you see a trough into which the pail from the well could be emptied. And of course, reminding us of the wells that are mentioned in the Bible, we find that many of the important events that we have recorded in the Old Testament and the New Testament surround or have the setting of the well or the spring, the watering place. At this Bedouin encampment, we stopped long enough, and as we stopped there, the man of the house came out to meet us. And as we sat under the shade of the acacia tree, I was reminded of Genesis 18 and 19, of how Abraham entertained the angels at one of his campsites. And the Bedouin man is here preparing us Bedouin coffee, which is very strong, but also very sweet, very thick, almost like syrup. He prepared some Bedouin coffee that we could all have a taste of it. He also made us some Bedouin bread, kind of pita, that rose about an inch and a half from the pan. The fuel for the fire, some dry briars found in the countryside nearby. The children in the area are now spoiled by the tourists because the children rush quickly to the trucks or the buses and they hope to get a toy or a bit of candy, chewing gum. These things, of course, are very fascinating for the children. The girls that wear the veil over their faces are considered to be of marriageable age, even though the girls pictured here might be no more than 13 or 14 years of age. The Bedouin have the custom of covering their faces, especially covering their mouth, because for the Bedouin, the mouth of a woman is that part of her anatomy that's most sexually exciting to the male. For the Chinese, it's a dainty little foot. In other societies, it might be something else. But anyway, we find for the Bedouin, they veil their faces for this reason especially. Again, the Bedouin women smoke very heavily, and they have learned the art of smoking beneath these veils without burning down their tents. We came to a cemetery. I must hasten on. We came to a Bedouin cemetery. Off to the left, you see headstones marking burial places. Off to the right, you have the burial site of a sheikh. And sometimes leaders among the people who might have, say, the rank of a sheikh, known for their intelligence, known for their wisdom, eventually they receive a certain amount of worship and respect from their people. Many of the people in this area might be nominally Islamic, but oftentimes you might say they're animistic as far as their religious practices are concerned. We had opportunity to go inside the sheikh's tomb. You see a box, probably the casket, and with the keffiyeh, the typical Arab headdress, probably is the skull. When I go back next time, I'm going to peek under that headdress and see what's there. Unfortunately, I did not do that the first time I visited here. Again, you see Arabic scrawled on the walls of the interior of the sheikh's tomb. Again, you see colored cloth at the top left of the picture. Again, something that the Bedouin regard with a certain amount of curiosity or superstition, and they place it on the tomb of the sheikh. We came to a place in Sinai where we saw structures called Nawamis, N-A-W-A-M-I-S, Nawamis. We came to a village of these structures, about 30 or 40 of them at this site. The structures are about 7 or 8 feet high, about 12, 14 feet in diameter. We have a small entranceway, which you see in this picture. And again, a good bit of curiosity and study has been made or directed towards these structures. Some have suggested that they were built by the children of Israel. Most recent suggestions say that these structures were built between 3500 and about 3000 BC, and that they may have been built originally for a place for the storage of bones of the dead. Among ancient peoples of the Western Asia, there was the custom of burying the dead, but after the flesh had decayed from the bones were taken up and placed in a box called an ossuary, or possibly placed in a structure like this, to preserve the bones from loss and further deterioration. Another fascinating aspect of these structures is that the roofs of these buildings are made of interlocking stone, and they have survived for many, many years. A very fascinating bit of architecture. Let's go on. Just a few scenic shots I looked at, we're going up towards the Serabit of Kadam, where we have the remains of an ancient Egyptian temple, the largest Egyptian temple outside of the land of Egypt. It's an open-air type temple. It was built by Egyptian miners. You see the rugged country that we climb. And we come to the Egyptian temple near the place where the proto-Sinaitic inscriptions were found in the interior of some of the caves and mines in the area. The Egyptian miners came to this area in search of turquoise, a semi-precious stone. And as they came, they built an Egyptian temple and hoped that as they honored the goddess Hathor, that she in turn would show them where the precious stone could be found. And so the miners had come here, and maybe 50 years later, 100 years later, another team of miners would come, and again they would add to the temple, and they'd also seek for the precious turquoise. In the interior of some of those mines, they scrawled some of those early writings that we associate with some of the early forms of writing as we know it today. This shows the layout of the Egyptian temple with various segments of it. Notice on the extreme right that the temple format changes towards a J, in the form of a J on its side. Again, the format of the temple had to change because at that point there was a little bit of a mountain outcropping, a little bit of a mountain there, or knoll. And so the form of the temple changed a little bit because of that. Here you see a picture of the goddess Hathor, usually depicted with long curls coming down on her shoulders to either side, sometimes depicted by a cow. And we see, of course, such images were usually defaced, literally defaced, because the Muslim peoples hate idolatry, and Jews hate idolatry, and Christians hate idolatry. So many works of art like this that we could wish today have been preserved without damage have been damaged by those who hated idolatry. You see an image of a baboon, sometimes called Moshe Dayan's baboon. Moshe Dayan is that Israeli leader that we remember as wearing a black patch over his one eye. He died a few years ago. He had a very valuable private collection of archaeological finds. In fact, he was a nuisance to professional archaeologists in that sometimes he would do some digging on his own at the archaeological site. Anyway, he obtained a very valuable collection, and when he died, his collection was willed to one of the museums in Israel. You see some of the inscriptions or stela. The base of the stela, you see what probably an Egyptian miner leading his donkey, and on the back of the donkey, some of the equipment. We come to St. Catherine's Monastery, and I guess with this we must stop. St. Catherine's Monastery, built in Sinai around 600 A.D., St. Catherine's Monastery is built like a fortress. You see how it dwarfs the bust in the foreground. And inside the walls, there are old church structures. Also, of course, this belongs to the Greek Catholic Church. Years ago, there were as many as 300 monks who lived at this monastery. Today, there are only 6 or 7. Of course, this shows that monastic life in the Greek Catholic Church is no longer popular. The monastery is important to us because valuable manuscripts of the Word of God were found here back in the 1860s by a German scholar named Tischendorf. And the inscription we're talking about is the Codex Sinaiticus. I understand that more recently other valuable manuscripts have been found here, but the monks who live here are reluctant to let them go and let Western scholars study them because they had a bad experience with the Codex Sinaiticus some years earlier. Also, the monastery is very important to us because in the monastery, icons, religious paintings of the Christian church have been preserved. Back around 800 AD in Western Europe, there was what we call the iconoclastic controversy, and many religious paintings were destroyed because it was believed that they were associated with idolatry. The controversy did not reach to Sinai in this remote place, and so many religious have a visit to Sinai and to study the countryside there. Good for the botanists to study the interchange of plant life between Africa and Asia. Good for the zoologists to study the animal life. Again, we do not say very much about the animal life, talk about the camel and how well-suited the camel is for the desert life and the donkey and so on. This we will have to save for some other time. And so Sinai, of course, is important to us because God's people wandered in Sinai in the wilderness wanderings. And they wandered in Sinai for the 40 years. Again, the present-day scholars who would suggest that the company of people who escaped from Egypt was a company of maybe just a few thousand people. But even if Israel numbered only a few thousand people, it would require the miraculous provision of God to sustain them for the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. We believe, however, that that congregation may have been close to 2 million people. And of course, God performed many miracles on behalf of his people during the wilderness wanderings to protect them and to keep them until that day they would enter into the promised land. Thank you. I think I should stop there.